My name is David Davis, and I represent Emily Ramirez for herself and his next friend for her son, AR. My attorney number is 34323. This court should reverse the trial court because it failed to instruct the jury on aggravation of a pre-existing condition with regard to pregnancy, improperly excluded John Smith's biomechanical opinions, and improperly excluded late disclosed evidence and failed to grant a continuance to allow its admission. The trial court also incorrectly calculated Ramirez's interest. Oh, there's these issues in order. First, the trial court erred in failing to properly instruct the jury on how to address a pre-existing condition with regard to pregnancy, which is a novel issue in Colorado. This was error because several doctors testified that Ramirez had pre-existing pregnancy complications that could cause or contribute to a premature birth. These include a prior miscarriage, a leak procedure on her cervix, and prior bleeding and cramping during the early portions of her pregnancy. And in closing argument, defense counsel argued in particular Dr. Gillum's concerns that the bleeding and cramping could cause a potential miscarriage, and argued that that showed that this pregnancy was too complex for the jury to find causation. And even though there was this evidence of pre-existing conditions, the jury was left without a proper instruction on what to do if it found that these pre-existing conditions caused the premature birth or caused it to occur earlier than it would have anyway. It was important for the jury to be properly instructed because the doctors, especially Dr. Ramos, testified that a collision can cause or contribute to a premature birth. Yeah, I think he specifically used those words, can contribute to a premature birth. Other doctors testified to that also, that it can cause complications with regard to the pregnancy. With that information, the jury could infer that the collision worked with the other pre-existing conditions to result in the premature birth in this case. And under the Lawson opinion, a jury can infer such aggravation occurred. For this reason, the jury needed to be properly instructed on aggravation as applied to pregnancy.
Well, counsel, let's talk about the standard of review here for a moment, because it's an abuse of discretion standard, right, for the trial court whether to give the instruction or not, correct?
It is a mixed question. It is abuse of discretion with regard to whether there's adequate evidence to support the instruction. It's reviewed de novo with respect to whether the instruction properly states the law.
Okay, but with regard to whether to give it or not, that's up to the trial court judge to a large extent, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so the evidence that had come in was, at least in part, that the issues that Ms. Ramirez had resolved prior to the accident. She had just come from an appointment where she was told that everything was resolved, right?
Were there any issues? The appointment she came through, I believe, was to check for whether her son was going to have Down syndrome. And at that appointment, they had said, no, it appeared he was going to be fine. It did appear that perhaps these other conditions had resolved. And some of the medical doctors said these conditions could cause or contribute to a premature birth. But maybe they didn't with regard to Ms. Ramirez.
Okay, so looking at this from the trial court judge's point of view, would you agree with me that it's up to the trial court judge to determine whether the jury could be confused about the cause of the damages and whether it should give an instruction so that it would separate out the damages? And so, you know, it's up to the trial court judge to determine whether that confusion potential is there. Would you agree with that?
I think the judge has to make a correct decision based on the evidence that's available, and if the evidence clearly allows the inference that there's an aggravation of a pre-existing condition, then he has to give the aggravation instruction. And there's case law that says a failure to give it when it's proper and supported by the evidence is reversible error.
Well, so help me understand then how the trial court judge, having heard the testimony that these issues had resolved before the accident, why was the trial court judge required to discern that the jury could get confused about these damages and was required to give this instruction?
Well, he was required to give it. The issue was discussed when the instruction was offered, that the jury could infer from this testimony that there was an aggravation of the pre-existing conditions. And that inference is permissible because the jury can believe all, some, or none of the expert's testimony. So they're fully able to believe that these issues can cause a premature birth or contribute to a premature birth and disregard the testimony that, well, we don't think they did in Mr. Ramirez's case. So that just like they can believe or disbelieve any causation evidence, they could disbelieve that these conditions did not contribute to the premature birth in this case. That being said,
so which expert was it that said that they would have contributed to the premature birth in this case?
I believe that Gillum, through his records, Hanley and Ramos indicated that these conditions could cause a premature birth or can contribute to a premature birth. Now,
if they weren't resolved? That's the problem that I'm having. If I'm the trial court judge and I hear testimony that these issues have resolved, I'm going to have difficulty thinking I need to give this instruction.
Well, I don't think they addressed whether they had resolved or not. They said for various reasons we think they didn't contribute to the premature birth in this case. But again, the court, just like any causation evidence, or the jury, excuse me, like any causation evidence can say, we don't believe that portion of the testimony that it didn't in this case. And then again, if you look again at defense counsel's closing, he says, look, this was a complicated pregnancy. There was a risk of a miscarriage. You can't find causation in this case. That basically invites the jury to make that inference that, well, maybe it was these pre-existing conditions. And if the jury doesn't have a proper instruction on what to do with those pre-existing conditions, they're likely to say, we're not going to award any damages.
Well, Mr. Davis, can you clarify from the record what was the evidence of a pre-existing condition that was existing at the time of the collision?
Well, there were certainly the effects on Mr. Ramirez's cervix from the leak procedure, and there were certainly the available inference from Dr. Jones testified, I don't think her cervix was strong enough to hold the membranes in, and that's why you had the premature rupture of the membranes leading to the premature birth. So if this leak procedure had weakened her cervix, and that's a reasonable inference that the jury could make, that would be an ongoing condition which could have contributed to the premature birth. Additionally, you had it appeared to have been resolved with the bleeding and cramping, which can be caused from a separation of the placenta from the uterus. However, if that was not fully healed, maybe it didn't, wasn't still bleeding, but that attachment, if the jury can infer that that's not going to be as strong as if that bleeding and cramping had never occurred, if the collision aggravates that, that could also be a cause of the premature birth, causing a separation there. So there were these conditions ongoing that the jury, from which the jury could infer a combination of the car accident and the pre-existing condition resulted in a premature birth.
Well, so as to the latter, was there a dispute in evidence whether that had been resolved? You said appears to have been resolved, and I'm just, if you can just clarify, was the testimony that that part was resolved?
I don't think there was definitive testimony either way as to whether it resolved. I know the last mention of it in the records, I believe, was May 19th, which was about 2 months before the collision. It's not mentioned after that, but there wasn't a doctor who said definitively, this was resolved, it's done, and it's not going to have an effect anymore. They all said, given that time frame, probably it wouldn't have an effect. But again, probably is different from it won't or didn't. The jury can disbelieve that probably.
There was mention of what, excuse me, counsel, there was what, mention of what on May 19th?
May 19th was the last mention of the bleeding and cramping in the record, which occurred before the birth.
And thank you.
Because of the jury could infer this, it was necessary to instruct the jury on aggravation of a pre-existing condition, and a failure was reversible error, so this court should reverse and remand for a new trial. The court should also reverse and remand for a new trial because of the exclusion of John Smith's biomechanical opinions. John Smith was qualified to offer these opinions. He has a master's in biomechanical trauma. He's taken numerous classes on the subject, has also written articles and given presentations on it. This issue was preserved under the low opinion because there were extensive discussions between counsel and the court with regard to the subjects of Smith's testimony. And it was explained what his opinions would be, what his testimony would be, and how it was pertinent to the case. And that information is sufficient to satisfy the requirements of an offer of proof. Now, in the amended answer brief, defense didn't dispute that Smith's testimony was proper rebuttal. I'd like to address it briefly anyway, because that was the basis of the court's opinion. And it's proper rebuttal because under the majority rule, evidence of how a collision occurred, the speed and intensity of the collision, allows an inference on damages. The jury can infer a high-speed, high-impact collision causes greater damages, and infer a low-speed, low-impact collision causes less damages. In this case, Butler testified this was a low-speed, low-impact collision. Therefore, that allowed the circumstantial evidence of the damages. Therefore, it was appropriate to rebut that circumstantial evidence, and that's what Smith would have done, saying even in a low-speed impact, you can have significant injuries, and that Mr. Mara's injuries were consistent with this type of collision and with the damage to the vehicles, and also that the forces acting on the vehicles are not the same as the forces acting on the occupants. Therefore, he undermined the defense theory that low-speed collision will result in little damages. For that reason, he presented appropriate rebuttal evidence, and the exclusion was prejudicial error. The trial court's errors instructing the jury and excluding evidence prejudiced Ramirez. The jury was not told what to do if it found a pre-existing condition resulted in the premature birth, and Ramirez was not permitted to rebut the inferences that a low-speed collision would only cause little damages. Therefore, the jury, and you can see the prejudice from the low damages award in this case. For these reasons, the court should reverse and remand for a new trial on damages. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
You have just under 3 minutes.
And please, the court. My name is James R. Alviar. I represent Mr. Haddon. My registration number is 6513. The big ticket item, in my opinion, is whether or not there was an aggravation of a pre-existing condition. During the course of discovery and during the course of the trial, I tried to ferret that information out, but it never came. Now, Dr. Hanley, a partner of Dr. Gilham, who was plaintiff's OBGYN, testified that all the bleed issues had resolved themselves by May 19th, and there weren't any issues after that. He also testified that the so-called leak procedure would not have contributed to the premature birth. And in fact, two OBGYNs testified, that's Dr. Jones and Dr. Hanley, that the cause of miscarriage and preterm babies is not understood by the medical profession. And that in itself is big, because that defines the issue. Now, we go back to what has been commented on, what the judge had to say regarding aggravation of a pre-existing condition, and he found there was absolutely no evidence of it. Now, to say that we can infer, the jury can infer, as the jury did in the Lawson case, I believe cited by plaintiff's counsel, that when you have chronic pain, the jury can infer that it will continue. But when you have two experts testify in a very specialized field that the medical profession does not understand why miscarriages occur short of acute trauma and a temporal relationship between the trauma and the miscarriage, nor a preterm birth, they don't understand. They can probably give you the mechanics of the breakdown of the cervix, water breaking, that sort of thing, but they don't know what initiates it. So how could a jury then infer that the accident caused the premature birth? I also would point out that there was absolutely no evidence a gynecologic injury or injury to the fetus. She went 2.5 hours later to see her OBGYN, that's Dr. Gilham, and he found no evidence of injury. She was in the hospital a fair amount of time, but as Dr. Haney testified, that's standard operating procedure for a pregnant woman who's been in an accident. She'll be held for 24 hours, but plaintiff in this case was not held that long. There is talk about plaintiff being prejudiced because Mr. Smith wasn't allowed to testify on biomechanical issues. First of all, a biomechanical engineer receives training in both medicine and engineering, mechanical engineering. There was no evidence whatsoever that he had any medical training, and to say he had a master's degree in biomechanical trauma says that absolutely nothing, because that training was not developed. Plaintiff's counsel asked for, and the court agreed that Mr. Smith, was an expert in engineering and accident reconstruction, but not biomechanical engineering. The case law that I cited to you characterizes biomechanical engineers as a rare breed.
Well, counsel, even assuming it's a rare breed and just assuming that this expert could have been qualified as a biomechanical engineer, was there ever an offering of him as an expert in that field?
No, there wasn't. And I will direct you to the point that counsel just made, that there was discussions about his qualifications, but in his brief, there's absolutely no citation to that area. It just simply didn't occur. Those issues didn't come up. I made contemporaneous objections when they tried to get into biomechanical opinions, and I want to emphasize that engineers are not qualified to testify regarding injury causation. That is a diagnosis, and engineers don't deal with that type of thing. They deal with forces.
Well, counsel, could you cite us to any case that says that, for example, a trial court doesn't have to allow expert testimony beyond the scope of what the expert's been proffered for and accepted for by the court?
Well, I would sidestep that question and just say that plaintiff's counsel did not satisfy Schreck. That's to say that it's the evidence testimony is relevant and that the witness is qualified. I would directly...
I prefer that you not sidestep the question.
Oh, okay. Well, that on top of that, there was no evidence presented that he was an expert in biomechanical engineering. And I think that is the key to it. But on top of that, I don't think there's any prejudice to the plaintiff, because ample testimony, and I've referenced all the different professions that were involved, testify on behalf of the plaintiff that the plaintiff was injured in the accident. So there is the causal evidence that was presented by plaintiff, but I think under the circumstances, the court did not abuse its discretion in disallowing Mr. Smith to testify as an expert in biomechanics. On the issue of the continuance, but let me ask this. Do you have any questions of me so far? All right. On the issue of the continuance, Rule 121 provides that there has to be good cause shown, and that's good cause is shown by exceptional circumstances and unforeseen circumstances. Rule 26 requires us to disclose, exchange information that's relevant to the case. Certainly her medical records would be relevant, and certainly radio frequency procedure recommendations would also be required to be disclosed. Now, it was counsel's responsibility and the plaintiff's responsibility to gather all that information. And I want to point out to you that some of those records went back as far as March, May, and June. We went to trial, December 11th or 12th. So there was a great deal of time they can say that they didn't get it until the records, until the end of November, but that does not change the responsibility of plaintiff's counsel to get the records, and the plaintiff, Emily Ramirez, to have informed her counsel of the procedures and the frequency of medical visits. The court found that I made an offer of settlement, I believe, on June 7th of, I believe it was 2011. It was for $15,000. The trial court tallied up the amount of interest that would have accrued at that time, as well as the plaintiff's costs, and found that it didn't reach the $15,000. I believe it was somewhere about $14,700, $800, so it was well below. So at that point, at the time of the date of June 7th, the interest that plaintiff is alleging that she is entitled to would have been arrested.
Okay, I do want to discuss that with you, counsel, because that would, if your interpretation of that statute, that it stops the payment of interest completely, that's not what 1317202 says. It just says, subsection 2 says, when comparing the amount of an offer of settlement to the amount of the final judgment, any amount of the final judgment representing interest subsequent to the date of the offer of settlement shall not be considered. In other words, in figuring out what, which is more, the offer of settlement or the amount of the judgment for purposes of that. But your reading of the statute to say that the plaintiff doesn't get any damages at all after the date of the settlement offer is, would put that statute in conflict with 1321.101, which says that the trial court is required to add interest, and it's, and the plaintiff is supposed to get interest up until the date of satisfaction of the judgment.
Well, all I can say to that is, I think the plain reading of 1317202 subsection 2 would indicate that the argument that I've made is correct. But one thing to keep in mind also is...
Well, how about my reading? You're just for purposes of comparison. Isn't that what the statute says? It's just when comparing the two? Because, for one thing, assuming you won't concede that, wouldn't you concede that that would put the two statutes in conflict with each other? And aren't we, as the Court of Appeals, supposed to avoid that sort of a conflict?
Well, I would concede that in part. What I would point out is that an offer of settlement or the prior offer of judgment are made just for that purpose, to try to compel parties to enter settlements.
Right. Otherwise, you get your costs if you're the offering party. Correct?
Okay.
Understood. But I don't see anything in the statute that says that the plaintiff no longer gets interest.
I guess I disagree with that.
Okay. Well, I'm trying to have you help me with your reading of the statute because it's conflicting with mine.
I don't have the statute in front of me, but I did cite it, quote it in my. In my brief towards the close of the arguments.
All right, so let me get back to my question. Aren't we supposed to avoid conflicts between two statutes?
I think when one statute is specific and the other one is general, I think that the specific statute trumps the general statute. So that's the basis for my view.
Thank you, counsel.
Does any more questions? Can I say for rebuttal, or no, I'm not entitled to it?
No.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to start by addressing John Smith with regard to his qualifications. It was admitted at trial that he had a master's in biomechanical trauma and that he takes numerous classes on the subject. For purposes of expert testimony, Rule 702 does not require that an expert be offered and accepted in a particular area of expertise. It just requires that the person have the qualifications necessary to render expert opinions, and those are set forth in the mandatory disclosures. In this case, Smith was designated to provide both accident reconstruction and biomechanical opinions, and his report, I believe, is in the exhibits from pages 250 to 272, and it sets forth in there biomechanical opinions. So it was well established that he was going to offer these opinions at trial. His CV was also disclosed in advance, and that's why you have a deadline for Shrek motions. And there were no Shrek motions filed in this case to exclude or limit the testimony of Mr. Smith in advance of trial, giving the trial court time to address the issue and plaintiffs as well.
Let me ask you the corollary to what I just asked your learned colleague, which is, are you aware of any case law that says that it's an abuse of discretion for a trial court to say no, once you've proffered him as an expert in X, and he's testified as an expert in X, and you haven't proffered him as an expert in Y, that it's an abuse of discretion for the trial court to allow him to testify as an expert in, not to let him testify as an expert in Y?
I'm not aware of cases that address the proffer of the expert either way. Most of the cases I've seen address plainly whether he had the qualifications or not. And in this case, it's important to note the judge did not exclude him based on lack of qualifications. That objection was made several times by my colleague, and each time the court disregarded that objection and said, but is this proper rebuttal? So there's no expression of concern by the trial judge as to whether Mr. Smith was qualified to offer these opinions. That was basically not addressed by the judge at all. The judge was concerned with whether this was proper rebuttal. If the court has any concerns about Smith's qualifications, the proper course would be to remand to the trial judge and say, trial judge, you decide in the first instance whether he has the qualifications. And because the judge wasn't concerned with his qualifications, there was no reason for a plaintiff to continue to bring the qualifications up or to expound upon his qualifications. Instead, we addressed the concern of the court, which was, is this proper rebuttal? And for that reason, the issue with qualifications really wasn't before the court. And his exclusion based on the rebuttal was error, and it requires reversal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. This case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. This concludes the arguments for this docket, and the court will be in recess.